time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Welcome to Sleep Science Today, the show where we talk sleep and the science behind sleep. Today we've got a new type of episode. We haven't really talked a lot about parenting and sleep yet, and I found a guest that I think is great for this issue. Her name is Sarah Kulig. She is both a mom and a mental health counselor that deals with sleep issues. So who better than Sarah to talk about this? Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to see what we get into here. So first, what I'd love to learn from you is how did you, you know, we know how you became a parent, but how did you become a sleep counselor? And what does that mean to you as a parent?
Great. I'll take you on a little journey of my how I arrived here. I think that my role as a counselor and now a sleep counselor is very much intertwined with my experience becoming a parent. So I guess I'll say I have struggled with insomnia off and on during my life, most acutely postpartum with my first child. I'd say I had acute insomnia as well as actual sleep deprivation. We'll get back to that, how that then integrated into my counseling work. I started off as an art therapist. I was working with teenagers doing art therapy. Did not talk a lot about sleep in the group practice I was in. We would ask people about it at intake and then sort of hope it got better if it wasn't too great, if we treated the mental health. We're like, okay, I hope it, you know, hope it gets better. I wouldn't say I had any expertise in sleep at all working with adolescents. When I was postpartum with my first child, I remember trying to sleep and feeling like I could levitate off the bed. I was so anxious, and anxious not only about having a child, but also trying to sleep. I was very, very concerned about sleep loss. It was a tough, dark time.
Wow.
What helped to shift things early on is I had a very helpful lactation consultant who at 2 weeks, when I was weeping in her office, said, you know what? We don't usually put babies on bottles this early, but we're doing it so that your spouse can give the kid a bottle early in the evening and you can sleep for 5 hours in a row. And I felt like I can make it. I can do this. I'd say after that, I continued to experience some insomnia, mostly around still worrying about sleep, really dreading nighttime wake-ups with my child. But I felt like I was getting enough sleep to function. It was all right. I went back to work with teenagers, and I remember viscerally, I don't think I'll ever forget it, a teenager sitting on my couch. It's the same couch I have behind me now in a different office. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, how are you today? And she said, ugh. I didn't sleep at all last night. I hardly feel like I can stand up. And I was like, what are you doing here? There is no work we're going to do that's going to be helpful for you. You have to fix your sleep. This is awful. But I didn't know what to do about it. I just was like, oh gosh, this is wild that we're trying to do counseling work when these teenagers, so many of them have this dysregulated sleep or sleep deprivation, what I now know are circadian sleep-wake rhythm disorders. So mm-hmm. I filed that away. Fast forward, 5 years later, or 3 years later, I had a second child. It was a much easier experience. I felt like I had a lot of tools under my belt, plan to ensure I got adequate sleep as well as the child. But then returning to practice, I wanted to make a change. I wanted to be more focused. I was interested in working with adults. And a friend suggested, hey, you should check out CBT for insomnia. And I was like, what even is that? I literally have never heard of it.
Right.
I honestly don't even think I knew counselors could treat insomnia. I was like, I think that's just a thing you live with and it gets better if you stop being so stressed. I looked into it. I was immediately taken. I felt like I started to understand my own sleep and sleep problems I had that had resolved in some ways because of what I was learning in CBTI.
Right.
I felt like I could just help clients in a really specific, important way that was personally meaningful and also satisfying as a counselor. I'm happy to talk more about CBTI if your listeners need a refresher, but I'll pause there. That's my long story, is kind of personal and professionally just led me to this place of this is what I'm really loving to do right now.
Wow. Wow. Well, you know, that's great. Yeah, you know, it's as I'm listening to you speak, it's, you know, part of that is a very similar story to me, you know, also being a clinician here and a mental health counselor. And initially, because we don't get any training in school about sleep when you're learning to be a mental health, you know, professional. And I didn't know that was something that, you know, was treatable either. I thought you had to go to a doctor and get pills or something. But then, like you, I started to learn about it. And it's like, oh, wait, okay, this makes a lot of sense. And now, to me, it's sort of second nature because of all the training and whatever. But initially, I was where you were. It's like, client has sleep problems. Well, I hope it gets better.
Absolutely. It's like we sort of are trained as generalists in a lot of ways. And a client is lucky if they happen to meet someone who can screen for sleep and then refer to a specialist. And from what I've read and in, you know, speaking with doctors and listening to things, I think the same is somewhat true in medicine, where doctors are trained as generalists and they're learning all sorts of different things. Mm-hmm. They spend a little tiny slice of time on sleep, and then some of them go on to be specialists, and you sort of hope that the doctors you're working with have that ability to at least screen for sleep and flag it as something that is treatable. There are problems we can uncover and make headway on. But it's kind of like both mental health and medical, it often sleep kind of falls into this chasm where everyone's like, oh, can we fix that? I think so, but I don't really know how. Which I think is something that we can continue to do better at. And I think talking in this way is one of those ways to increase awareness of this is not just a byproduct of mental health or medical problems. There's also things we can do to help it on its own.
Well, and that's, you know, where you talk about CBTI, sort of the gold standard treatment for insomnia today. You know, I think more people are slowly becoming aware of that term and all. But tell me, from your perspective, you know, here you are running a practice. You're a mom. You're also living with kids and dealing with kids' issues. What types of things come up in practice? How does CBTI fit in, if at all? Give us a sense of how that works for you.
Sure. And feel free to chime in and redirect me if I don't quite answer the question. But so I think one thing I love about CBTI is that it gives you we go over a foundation of basic sleep. How does it work? Well, it's not something I can will into existence. It's this involuntary process that is made up of sleep drive, having a pressure to sleep, timing it properly, and trying not to be really stressed out about it, having that kind of relaxation response that you can tap into. So, you know, in practice, I think of CBTI also almost as a BCTI, behavioral cognitive therapy for insomnia, because so much of the behaviors start first and our thoughts then change because our behaviors shift, and then our story has to be new because all of a sudden I'm actually a good sleeper because I made these changes. But you can't change that thought until you try it out. I think of these things all the time with my children's sleep, and I wish I had known them when they were born. Like, so much. Think about, you have this child. The preparation for sleep you've been given is they need to sleep in a room with you for SIDS prevention. You know, being in the same room is important. They should be in their own sleep space, and they need to sleep on their backs. And you're like, okay, great, but nothing is really said about, at least for me, maybe people have different experiences, how much sleep does a newborn need? And actually, what is the variation there? Because just like adults, it's not a one-size-fits-all. And the variation for newborns especially is like, you can have an 8-hour difference in a sleep need for a newborn. So you're sending a parent home, maybe two parents home from the hospital, with a person they just met, And your first task is to help them sleep, and you have no idea what their sleep needs are like. And I don't think people even think about that as a question of, oh, one thing I have to figure out is, do I have a child who's more on the shorter end of things or who just could sleep 20 hours? And I'm going to say they're a great sleeper, but it's just their high sleep needs kid, you know?
Right.
So I think CBTI, thinking about, well, what is my personal sleep need? I'm going to figure that out with a sleep diary over several weeks. That I've seen that be transformational for adults when they say, I thought I was a bad sleeper, but you're telling me I actually might be someone who needs 6.5 hours of sleep and not 9 like I thought I was supposed to get. I think that for children, it's a similar thing of, like, we could be curious. We could send parents home with a sleep log with their newborn to not only keep track of the days because it can be such a blur, but to keep track of, well, where is my child tending to sleep at throughout this, like, you know, 7-week period? What are the patterns we're starting to notice so that this feels like less of a mystery and I can feel more empowered with how I'm supporting my child to sleep versus, well, I think they're supposed to sleep all the time and they're not, and now I'm really stressed about it. Mm-hmm. So pause there and see, you know, if you want to redirect me or ask more. Well, but those are helpful, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm curious. You're talking about sort of tracking the child's sleep and all. Is there something that you're aware of that's out there that's available for parents to use, or is this something that they're just going to develop on their own?
I mean, I kind of, there's nothing I used in particular. I think that could I have done it better with my first child? I would have they send you home with a little pee and poop log with a newborn so you can track to make sure their digestion and all of that stuff is working well and that they're being adequately fed and growing. Mm-hmm. And I think of something like that around sleep could be so helpful. It's so simple. It doesn't need to be fancy. And I think the idea of, like, a parent being like, oh yeah, we laid them down at 8 and they got up 2.5 hours later. Okay, I'll shade in those that space on my hours chart, my sleep diary. Mm-hmm. I think could be really grounding because those early weeks feel very amorphous. You don't know what day it is. And I think it can be simple. And then you go to a 2-week follow-up and you can show your doctor, oh, like, you know, in general, I think my kid is sleeping about 18 hours a day. That's what I'm noticing. Or actually, they're sleeping closer to 14. I think we're giving this kid adequate time to sleep and opportunity. Like, how's this looking? I think it doesn't have to be fancy. I think it's similar to insomnia work where, yeah, you can use a wearable to track your sleep, but that's not getting at your perception of the problem. Right. And it's also not accurate in the same way that, like, how I'm noticing my own sleep is accurate to my kind of satisfaction. So, you know, and I think new parents don't need more tools that are, like, more complicated than just pencils and papers. And it's just helpful information to share with a provider and to help ground you in, oh, I'm learning something about this kid. I'm learning their preferences. And if we know their schedule, they don't have much of a schedule early on, but if we know a little bit more about their sleep need and such, maybe if there's two of us in the household, we can feel like we're sharing this burden a little more of the nighttime wake-ups.
So, you know, basically it sounds like the suggestion is if the parents have developed their own chart, just sort of 24 squares for a day, and then they're really just looking at, when was my child sleeping? When was my child awake? Are there any other factors that you think would be super important for them to bring to the doctor other than that?
Right. I mean, it depends on the child, right? And I can't speak for any specific child, and I don't work with children on sleep. I'm really thinking about it from the perspective of being a parent who happens to know quite a bit about sleep, mm-hmm. behavior sleep med. But I think the, like, bit so similar to insomnia work with adults. I think the basic sleep patterns, what you're noticing, how long they're napping for, and anything obvious, like, oh, I notice my child is snoring. I have talked to parents whose children snore, and you definitely want to talk to a PCP about that. We don't talk about that enough, you know.
Right.
But just that basic information, what I find with adults when we keep sleep diaries like this is if you get too detailed, you're reinforcing the stress about sleep, and I'm being hyper-vigilant to it. I think a relaxed approach of, yeah, it was about okay, they took about a 2-hour nap today, and then at, you know, 5, they took a short 45-minute nap, and then they seemed ready for bed around 7:30. I think they slept about 5 hours. You know, chill. Just be chill about it, and then you've got a nice place to start. I really think that it's easy also as a parent, and I've talked with other parents, I hear this in groups of parents, to sort of say, like, oh, they're sleeping terribly. I think keeping a sleep diary in times like that can be very grounding, because you might notice, yeah, actually they are sleeping really badly. Or you might notice, well, we had one really bad night, but the other ones were okay. I'm just really focused on that bad night because it sucked so much and I don't want it to happen again. So it can be very clarifying. Well, what actually is the nature of the problem here? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's important with that, that, you know, if they have that point where they said, my kid is sleeping terribly, to take mm-hmm. some notes about specifically what does that mean? Because that's, you
exactly.
know, taking that to a doctor is like going to a car mechanic and saying, my car is broken.
Well, yeah. What's
broken? You know, what does terribly mean? Were they crying? Were they, you know, what was happening that you perceived to be terrible?
Yes, absolutely. It's like, is it terrible because my expectation for their sleep is unrealistic? And the only way we'll know that is if I'm bringing a diary to a PCP or some more specifics, and for them to say, yeah, that does seem unusual, or, you know, that's kind of within the realm of okay, and maybe it's my expectation that needs to be adjusted. And that's okay, too. I think, great, change in expectation, that's a great place to start, you know? And I feel like I've had to experience that in my clinical work, and I experienced it as a parent all the time. It's sort of figuring out how can I support my children's sleep to be as good as it kind of can be, and how can I also accept that it's not going to be perfect? And guess what? Their sleep is going to affect mine as well, and I'm going to have to figure out how to cope with that, whether it's right. changing their sleep or my own behaviors.
And that's actually a perfect segue into a commercial break here, because when we come back, I'd like to talk more about the parent side now and the issues the parents may have. So we will be back in a minute on Sleep Science Today, and we'll continue talking about parenting and sleep.
Have you ever wondered why you can't sleep well? Well, there could be lots of different reasons. In order to figure it out, I wrote the book, Why Can't I Sleep Well? It includes 150 common sleep questions that are asked and answered, and I provide all of the supporting science and evidence to address each of the questions. I encourage you to get a copy of Why Can't I Sleep Well by Andrew Kolsky. It's available at www.sleepsciencetoday.com.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle, and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at UKHealthRadio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tena-sensitive care pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena-sensitive care pads with the skin comfort formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, we're back on Sleep Science Today. We've got a special guest who is both a parent and a sleep counselor. Her name is Sarah Kulig, and we are now going to move over a little bit to actual types of client issues that you see, meaning parents with sleep issues and parents who are concerned about how their kids are sleeping well.
Yeah.
So tell us, what are the common things that you see?
You know, and I think I see this again as a counselor, and as a parent going to, you know, play groups and elementary school events and such. I think a big issue. I think I'd like to start with postpartum and what I've seen with mostly friends and peers, which is I think one big issue, and this is a systemic issue, is we are asking parents to go back to work when their children are still so, so, so small and their sleep is, you know, in some ways kind of all over the place. You're still sorting that out. So I think that a big issue is because parents are being expected to work when sleep is probably still pretty tricky and stress is still pretty high, there's a lot more pressure on that child to perform sleep. And that is hard. You can't have a 2-month-old perform sleep any better than they probably already are, in my opinion. Right. Outside of having a safe sleep environment and doing your best to give them the right sleep opportunities, their brain is changing so much. And so I think that that's one of the biggest issues, is that stress. And how do I as a parent cope with the stress of trying to work, trying to get to know this child, try to take care of them? Who are my supports here? What can be done to make this easier? That's a huge issue. I think issues we also see are that transition for, you know, when children's naps during the day change. I encountered this myself, where with my first child around the age of 3, that precious afternoon nap seemed to be harder and harder to make happen. And I do recall trying to lay in bed with him and sort of gently hold him long enough that we might both fall asleep. He didn't need the nap anymore. It was just like, I needed the nap. I needed the rest. I was unwilling to give it up. And it's like, well, was that my sleep problem or his sleep problem? It was probably mine. With my second child, I didn't have that same experience. It's sort of like, oh, I'm sad that time's over. Right. How else can I meet my need for rest and for having a break? Because that is what the nap is for me. And if he doesn't need it, I still kind of need that like moment of pause. So what, you know, are there people that can help take care of him? Is there an activity he can reasonably do on his own for even 15 minutes as a 3-year-old? Are there other times in the day where I can get that break? So nighttime is a whole thing. I think an issue I see in also clinical practice, and I'd like to see more of because I'd love to continue to work with parents, is how do we react to our children when they wake up at night? Mm-hmm. Because for people with insomnia, if it's someone with insomnia, that wake up at night can be horrifying and a source of stress on its own when it's your own body waking you up. So when you have a child waking you up, that stress could be at a whole other level, and your response might not be as effective as it could be because you're carrying that stress. So I think that managing nighttime wake-ups, whether through trying to train your child out of them or through adjusting your response so that they're less activating for everyone. I see that in lots of places. And I think part of insomnia work is just working on how do I cope with the inevitable interruptions to sleep because they happen.
Yeah, you know, let me ask something about that. Mm-hmm. So I can imagine a situation where you have a parent who has chronic insomnia before they become a parent. Mm-hmm. And then they have a child, and now they've got all these additional issues to work on, and now their insomnia is being, you know, triggered because they have to keep waking up. I can picture that easily. Here's where I'm curious what your experience is. If you have someone that didn't have that issue, they become a parent, and now they have these issues related to just dealing with their kids' sleep and all, how do you as a clinician determine whether or not they have insomnia or whether they're just dealing with sleep deprivation because they're dealing with a kid, or maybe both? You know,
yeah.
I'm just kind of trying to get some clarity there.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably so much variety that it's hard to give a simple answer. I think that's probably where I'm going to be this broken record. The sleep diary comes in. Because I think to cope with a wake up with a child, how long does it last? How stressed out are you about it? I think talking about the narrative you have around it is useful. I'd wonder, you know, how are you coping with a nighttime wake up? Is the child, are they older and then they, you know, they're 4 or 5 and they end up in your bed and that's how the nighttime wake up ends? Well, that tells me maybe there's some fear about not sleeping that would suggest maybe a little more of an insomnia vibe, you know, where it's kind of like, I'll sleep at any cost. And so whatever we've got to do, even if in the long term, this is not where I actually wanted to see things go. I think, you know, sleep deprivation is its own kind of state. So I think I would be looking at, well, how much sleep do you actually end up getting? And also, what is your daytime functioning like? Are you experiencing daytime sleepiness? Is it incredibly hard for you to get up in the morning? God forbid, are you driving and feeling drowsy? That would say like, oh, wow, these wake-ups, they're so excessive that they're really eating into your sleep in a way that's dangerous for you, versus insomnia where you maybe are functioning fine, you're tired but wired, and you are getting baseline enough sleep, but the stress around it is really tiring you out, and it's a burden in a different kind of way. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think the point is that in some of these things, it's never going to be 100% clear this or that, because everything kind of folds together when you're dealing with these things. Yeah. Are there other sort of common myths or things that parents struggle with when you're working with them and they're just trying to understand better?
Yeah. I think one of the things I notice most often, again, it's so interesting. I think it happens in clinical practice with people who are parents who I'm working with. It will come up in conversation. We're not treating their kids' sleep challenges, but their own experience of sleep affects how they parent their children to sleep. So it comes up. And it comes up when I talk to parents or stuff I see online. I think one of the biggest problems, in addition to the pressure that parents have to train their children to sleep and maybe have poor, unrealistic expectations because they have to get back to work so fast. Mm-hmm. I think one of the biggest problems I personally see is just the commodification of sleep. When you are a parent, and it continues as your children get older, is that what you're given, the information you're given, is kind of an Amazon gift list of things you need to make your child sleep. It's a white noise machine. It's a very specialized white noise machine with timers and different like frequencies. It's a okay to wake clock, which I do like those, but they can get excessive. You know, we can get a little intense about using them. It's special sheets. It's having the blackout curtains. It's having little socks that monitor all kinds of data about your child as they're sleeping. It's video monitors. It's feeling like, well, I have this kid, and in order to make them sleep, I need all this stuff, or it won't happen. And I think that sends the wrong message, because like you and I have talked about in our consult group, and I think in sleep behavioral sleep literature, is that sleep is inevitable. People sleep. Your child does sleep. And when we get distracted by all this stuff, I think we miss the point of, well, I want to figure out what my child's sleep needs are. I want to understand what time of day they typically sleep best. And I want to make sleep kind of a nice experience. And guess what? You can do that with a bath and a book. You don't need a lot of stuff. You don't need super fancy bath bubbles. You don't need a perfect towel. You don't need 12,000 different nighttime books. You just need some simple ones. It's like, it's actually easy, but we're like tricked into, you need all this stuff and they need a meditation and they need a perfect playlist. And it's like, oh, la la, that's too much.
Right.
No, that's my business, I think.
Yeah. And I wonder, you know, I am not aware of any research about this, but I wonder, if we start the kids off with all of these tools and extra things to improve their sleep or you know, we have the best intentions, but I wonder if that doesn't actually negatively impact them in the big picture, because now, well, I can't sleep without my white noise machine. I can't sleep without all these things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even though we have the best of intentions, are we setting them up for failure down the road?
Right. It would be interesting research to look into. It's one of those other parallels with CBTI in clinical practice. We talk about sleep effort. How much effort are you putting into trying to sleep? Typically, sleep effort does the opposite of what you want it to do, because it takes your efficacy out of sleep. It makes it seem like sleep is something you have to do versus sleep is something that will happen if you just sort of set up generally reasonable circumstances, like a safe place to sleep, proper timing, you know, not a bedroom that's 95 degrees. You know, it's pretty simple. It's not super fancy. And I think it's very similar to children of, well, how can I set the stage but not get super involved in it so that they learn that they can sleep, that they're, all children are good sleepers. We just have to kind of discover with them what allows them to be so. I also think sometimes all of these products can distract from, like, actually, is there a sleep disorder present? Like, is your kid actually a bad sleeper because they have sleep apnea and you're trying to treat it with, like, special blankets and, like, you know, nighttime tea? Just to say, I think sometimes when things become so complicated, then we miss actually other important things that really would make a difference. So,
right.
I have one other sleep myth that I feel like as a mom I really want to highlight that can be harmful.
Sure.
I could just have collected dollars for every time I heard this and really bought myself a nice meal out, which is the myth of, or the pressure to sleep when the baby sleeps, rest when the baby rests. And I heard that, and again, I will not ever forget the feeling of shame and fear that I felt when especially my first child would be sleeping, and I could not rest. I did not want to. My body was not prepared to. I think it's potentially a reasonable thing to suggest to someone when given some context, but I think adults and children sleep differently. Mm-hmm. Your baby has a different sleep schedule than you do. And you're not necessarily going to sleep when the baby sleeps, and that's okay. It's a possibility. It's not a necessity. Right. I think that's one of those things that just gets said offhand and can really be hard for new parents to hear, because it's not always the thing they need. It's like, I need to have tea and read a murder mystery while my kid is sleeping. I'm not sleeping, you know. And in fact, for me, having had insomnia, with my second child, I really didn't work to sleep when my baby slept. I worked to sleep when I actually was sleepy. And I actually think that's what really helped my insomnia dissipate. I felt like I had a sleep drive that was much stronger. I could fall asleep when I was ready. And that was some of the most satisfying sleep I ever have gotten, is those early stages, because I wasn't trying to rest during the day and sleep. And I was allowing myself to follow my schedule a little more, and I had this great sleep pressure that built up, and then my sleep felt so much better. So that's my public service announcement, is to take that advice with a grain of salt. It might not be the thing you need.
Right. Well, it's, you know, the interesting thing is, and this is kind of what you're talking about, is we're solving a problem before the problem is there with the kids. So in other words, if we're doing the sound machine and we're doing the special this and the special that, they haven't even been alive long enough to have a problem, first off, you know. And secondly, you know, probably the interesting thing would be if we had a power outage, so all these things that you bought didn't work, the kid would probably get the best night of sleep. Right. I'm going to stop us there real quick for another commercial, and we'll come back on that thought.
Great.
Have you ever wondered why you can't sleep well? Well, there could be lots of different reasons. In order to figure it out, I wrote the book, Why Can't I Sleep Well? It includes 150 common sleep questions that are asked and answered, and I provide all of the supporting science and evidence to address each of the questions. I encourage you to get a copy of Why Can't I Sleep Well by Andrew Kolsky. It's available at www.sleepsciencetoday.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, we're back on Sleep Science Today. Again, I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We've got Sarah Kulig, and we were talking about what does a real night of sleep look like if we didn't have all the extra bells and whistles that we think we need?
Mm-hmm. You know? What would it look like? You know, it's all of these things. I think it's sort of thinking about them as these are tools that can be useful, but they can't become necessities. They have to be things where I can go camping with my kids and I'm not going to buy a battery powered white noise machine. And either they'll sleep well or they won't, but I don't have to see it as a crisis. You know, I could see that as this is just, you know, one night of many, and I have a good baseline with my kids. And so after we're not camping, like, they can go back and have their usual sleep environment and be all right. I think I just really like the idea of moving slow with things, you know, tools that you introduce with your kids, and keeping things as simple as you can, because I think it sets them up to be independent sleepers later on down the road. If it feels like, well, these are routines I can do myself, I can take care of my sleep environment myself, it's not too big a deal.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, I think my advice to patients would be, let's see if there's a problem first. And if there's a problem, then we can look for the best solution. Yeah. So, you know, we're talking about white noise machines. Okay, let's say I live in an apartment building and I have thin walls and my neighbor plays music that, you know, makes it hard for me to sleep. Okay, well, now maybe I want a white noise machine for the intention of drowning out that other noise that's keeping me awake. Problem first, then we put a solution.
Yes.
But when we do all the solutions first, it's really, like you said, it's consumerism right. more than it is purposeful.
That's my feeling about it. You know, I think that a white noise machine is something you can introduce if, like, yeah, you have a noisy environment and you've learned that your child, just like anybody, we all have that arousal threshold or just how noisy and do things need to be before I wake up. Some people are very high up and it's like you could chainsaw next to them and they're not going to wake up. And some people are really low and so it's like a pin drops and I'm awake, I'm ready to go. That's helpful. It's good that we all have that variety. It's, I think, adaptive. It's like you can have a kid for a little while and learn, oh, nothing wakes this kid up. They don't need a white noise machine. Oh, I've got a kid who's a little more sensitive. Like, maybe that would be nice for them to have, in general, a fan or a little sound going. Mm-hmm. But you wait to learn about your kid before you do it. You don't have to do it right away and kind of take the fun out of figuring. Maybe it's not fun in the early stages, but I think it's sort of interesting to try and learn that right. about a child or about ourselves, you know?
So, you know, you also spoke earlier about when you're a new parent for the first time, you bring the baby home, they have you kind of tracking the pee and poop log, you called it. But so let's say there's some people out there listening to the show who are getting ready to become first-time parents. Mm-hmm. They haven't been through any of this. They only hear the stories of what their friends and, you know, coworkers tell them. Are there some specific things that they could or should do in preparation of bringing home a new child when it comes to not only the child's sleep, but their own sleep?
Yeah. I mean, I think first things first, definitely talk to your primary care physician for yourself and for your soon-to-be child about advice they have because they know you best. I think that, in general, something I wish I had done and that I think can be helpful for people is to figure out, how can I think ahead to how I can cope with this? I often think about how anxiety is, at its core, a tendency to overestimate the severity and frequency of the thing we're afraid of, coupled with an underestimation of our ability to cope with that. Mm-hmm. So I think that for a lot of new parents, it's nice to think about, like, okay, say I have a child who struggles to sleep. They have colic or they've got something going on in their belly and it just is really tricky. How can I cope with that? What are the things I can do? Who are the people that might be there for me? Do I have a friend who will come and hold the baby so I can sleep in the afternoon? Do I have access to and resources to hire an overnight doula or a sleep consultant if I needed to? Do I have a partner who we can tag team in a way that allows us both to get kind of a bare minimum amount of sleep and feel all right? And can I just expect that this will be challenging? And so when it is challenging, I don't also feel like caught off guard by it. It's not planning for every outcome, but it's being thoughtful about what do I know helps me cope with stress and deciding to put that in place ahead of time. I'll share my second child. He had some food issues and milk protein allergy, and the first 2 weeks of his life I really could not lay him down. Like, we couldn't, you lay him down and he was just uncomfortable. And my spouse and I was very lucky to have a spouse who was like able to dive into this. We created a schedule where I would sleep the first shift, he would stay up with the little kid and play a video game, have a nice time. Then he'd go to sleep at like midnight and I would do the second shift, kind of middle of the night. I'd watch a movie holding the child, had a great time. Sometimes he would have watched the movie during his first shift and I watched the movie. We talked about it in the morning. And then, you know, I would then get a little sleep right before wake up and he would take the child back. And we knew that eventually things would shift. Our PCP was like, I think after a couple of weeks, he'll start to adjust to being kind of alive out here and he'll be all right. And we're like, this is what we have to do. And we can do this. This is a plan that meets all of our needs a little bit. And we tried to make it a little fun. And instead of every night wishing it wouldn't happen and then being kind of frustrated that it was. So I think for new parents, just thinking about your relationship to sleep, thinking about the expectation you have about what an infant's sleep will be like, getting more information about that from medical providers, you know, reliable resources, behavioral sleep med folks, I think really can help. It demystifies it. It helps you know what you do have control over and what you really don't. I really advocate for making the nighttime wake-ups as fun as you can.
Right. Well, actually, I was going to ask a little bit about that, which was, you know, and I don't know that there's any right answer to this, so mm-hmm. I'm just asking you your experience as a parent now, as a mom. You know, I have patients who will talk about, you know, one person is sort of responsible for the nighttime stuff, the other person is responsible for the daytime stuff. I have other patients where they do, you know, every other night or splitting the night. Have you, just in your experience and your discussions with other parents, with patients, things, is there a method that seems to be the most effective for parents to deal with those nighttime issues?
Yeah, it's a great question. It really varies. From what I understand it, as a parent, from what I've read, and as a clinician, it makes sense to me that, so regarding like sleep training, where maybe you're trying to help your child not be waking up and getting out of bed at night or crying out, mm-hmm. you sort of just choose a method and you stick with it so that you're not, well, we sort of tried it and then they put up a fight and so we tried this other thing and we never gave it enough time to really settle in, because change takes time. Right. The consistency, and I think choose a method that allows you as a parent to feel confident. Because they might fight you. And you will doubt yourself at 2 a.m. So if you're like, well, we chose the method and this is what it is and I'm going to really do my best, you know. And then after a couple of weeks, if it really doesn't work, you're like, okay, well, we gave it enough time. I really stuck with it. Turns out this is not the right thing for my child. Let's go back to the drawing board and try a different thing. Really give it the full faith effort again. But I think you got to just have the plan. You can't make the plan at 2 a.m. It's the same with insomnia and dealing with middle-of-the-night wake-ups. You can't decide then what you'll do. You need to know ahead of time. Your brain will not work well at 2 a.m.
Right.
But I think it really is knowing your family and having a very earnest conversation that details, well, how, you know, who is in the best position to manage this? Is it best for us to share it? Or is one of us, maybe you're trying to do night weaning, and so the person who has been feeding the child actually shouldn't be involved because that's asking a kid too much. You know, hey, I'm going to come and comfort you, get you back to sleep, and I can't feed you, and that's what you're used to. That can be really hard. So I think for me, I had my spouse do that because I was like, no way I'm going to have that fight in the middle of the night. I can't handle it. It's too, I'll break down. It'll be too hard.
Yeah.
And I think it's knowing kind of your sleep needs and just how you are as a parent, and giving it again a full faith effort so you're not giving it a day or two and then it doesn't work. Well, yeah, most things don't really work after a day or two. Sometimes they do and that's really exciting, but usually it takes a while. I'll share my trick for what helped my spouse do. We used kind of the Ferber method of, okay, you go in after 1 minute the first day, and then, I don't know, 3 minutes. I don't know the intervals because I didn't participate in it. But what we talked about is, okay, with our second child especially, we knew it would be more challenging. He's a little bolder personality. We're like, he's going to let us know he doesn't like this. And sitting there and listening to him cry for 20 minutes will not be pleasant. And my spouse was like, okay, well, we know he's safe. You know, he's safe during that time. He's in his crib. He doesn't need to eat. He's at an age, and we've checked with a PCP. He's fine. So how will I cope with this time so it's not more distressing for me? Well, he had some noise-canceling headphones. He had selected a great video game ahead of time that he only got to play during night wake-ups. And he just set his little timer. Could not hear our child. And again, he was in a safe place. It wasn't, there was nothing beyond, gosh, we're making a change and this is hard. And I think what happened for him is that he almost looked forward to the wake-ups a little bit for a while, because he's like, oh, I get to play my video game and it's really nice. And then I know what to do with my kid at the interval. And it worked pretty well. And I think that's similar to how I might approach nighttime wake-ups with an adult client or difficulty sleeping as well. time feels longer when it is not pleasant. If you're listening to your child cry for the allotted 10 minutes, that's not fun. If you're awake in the middle of the night and you have nothing to do that you've planned, that also will feel like an hour. So is there a really fun romantic comedy book, like, you know, some kind of right romanticy book you want to read at that time? Do you have a fun knitting project? Is there something pleasant you can do to minimize the extra stress that's going into an already kind of tough situation? So I think he rocked the overnight sleep training, and I highly recommend trying to make it actually a little fun if you can.
Yeah, no, I love that, because it's all about, you know, like you said, behavior is so big in sleep in so many ways, as we've seen through the conversation here. And that last part, you know, from a therapeutic standpoint, is one thing to tell a person, don't do something, because then they're sitting there like, well, then what do I do? And it brings on all this anxiety. But if you say, do this, you know, play your video games and put on your noise-canceling headphones, then that's easy, because now I know exactly what to do when this comes.
Right. So. And then in the morning when the child wakes up, there's more of a sense of like, hey, we did it. Like, we got through that. And like, we can see progress. And I think without that, you can have this stress clouding your perception where you might be like, oh, another night we had to do that. And it just was awful. I think it the more we can kind of take care of our own stress, and again, it's not going to ever be stress-free, but if you can adjust it a little bit, I think it then can make it more clear what is happening for my kid. And I'm more able to say like, hey, great job. You know, you went to sleep after 30 minutes instead of 60. Like, that actually is progress.
Right.
You know?
Well, Sarah, time has come and gone. It seems like it's 5 minutes, but it's actually been a lot more than that. So, you know, thank you so much for joining us and for a wonderful conversation. I'll give you the last word. Any particular thing, message you want to specifically make sure that a parent hears?
I think the idea of don't treat the problem before you know what the problem is a great one. Talk to your primary care. If you don't feel like you're getting great answers, seek out other providers and you know, keep a sleep diary if you need to. It always helps.
Right. All right. Well, Sarah Kulik, thank you so much for joining us. To the new parents out there, congratulations, and follow some of this advice. It'll make your life easier. And I appreciate everybody joining us on Sleep Science Today. You can always go to www.sleepsciencetoday.com. You can join our mailing list and get notifications of issues and things coming up and future shows. And you can even get a copy of my book there, Why Can't I Sleep Well? Thank you so much. We'll see you on a future episode of Sleep Science Today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, Sleep Science Today and sleep better tonight.